Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop, and as always, I'm joined by Hui Huynh of the Alabama Woodworker.
How you doing today, Guy?
I'm awesome. Thank you for asking. And Sean Walker of Simple Cove.
Hey, Guy and Hui. How are you guys doing?
Good. Doing great.
This podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspective on how we get things done in our own shops. So we also have a new Patreon account, and right now we have one level, and we are simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the costs of bringing you this awesome podcast. So please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife, and we sincerely hope that you'll give us our support. And also make sure you listen all the way to the end of the show. We're going to give a shout out to some folks who we think are notable woodworkers who to follow on social media, and that's a new thing we're trying this time, so... So let's get right into it. Hui, you have the first question.
First question is from Zach's Wood Studio, and he writes, "Hey guys, I'm expanding my sharpening setup and looking to add a grinder for initial squaring and hollow grinding. I'm looking at cheap options, and I'm torn between a slow speed grinder 8-inch or the cheap wet grinder like made by Wen. Do you have any recommendations or suggestions?" Well, actually, I have a Rycon 1-horsepower slow-speed grinder, and I have it with a set of CBN wheels. And there are typically two speeds for bench grinders, and that's 1750 RPM on the slow side or 3600 RPM on the high side. And what Zach is talking about is a 1750 RPM. A slow-speed grinder will generally generate less frictional heat, and it helps prevent the steel from overheating when you're grinding a new edge. When you overheat the steel, you end up tempering the blade, and that rearranges the whole molecular structure of the blade, and which lowers the edge retention. This is also called bluing, and it's literally called bluing because it causes the steel to turn blue. A slow speed grinder at 1750, it can still overheat the steel, and it just takes a little bit longer to overheat the steel than maybe, you know, the high speed grinder. A slow speed grinder at 1750 can still be used by periodically dipping the blade in water, and that'll reduce the amount of heat that's generated on the blade. What I did also was to replace the aluminum oxide wheels that come standard on a slow speed grinder with CBN wheels. And CBN stands for cubic boron nitride. And CBN wheels are an aftermarket product that, when outfitted on a bench grinder, they produce a very low spark. They produce practically no heat buildup, and they never get smaller, so they never need to be redressed or flattened, and they're pretty much next to impossible to wear out. But they're not cheap. They're between $100 to $150 a wheel. I bought my wheels from woodturnerswonders.com, and it came with a lifetime warranty. So, you know, even though they are expensive, they pretty much last forever. An alternative to a slow-speed grinder is a wet grinder. Probably the most well-known wet grinder is the Tormek, and it's also happens to be the most expensive. But there are copies out there made by Wen, Grizzly, and Triton, and these are much less expensive copies. Now, I can't speak to the quality of the wet grinder since, one, I don't own one, and I've actually never used one. But a wet grinder is actually much slower than even a slow-speed grinder at about 120 RPMs or less. And it's also water-cooled, so it has a little trough underneath the grinding wheel. The wet grinders are great because they almost guarantee you're not going to temper the steel. And the slower speed also gives you much more control to help reduce the amount of material that you're removing from the tool edge. They can be a little bit messy with the water, and the abrasive wheels, they do wear out over time, and they do need to be dressed periodically. And by dressing, I mean re-flattening and retuning that the grinding wheel so that it's...
Don't they have like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but don't they have like different dressing things so you can make it a fine grit or a coarse grit, things like that?
That I don't know the answer to, again, because...
That's what I thought. They have like a little thing you put on there. So you put it on there, you do the coarse grit. And then you put this thing on there again. It's like, you know, the wheel dressing thing. And you put it on there and it gives you a fine grit.
I think that's dependent on what kind of wheel you get.
Now that's what comes with those wet grinders. Like the Tormek, that's how it's done. I believe.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Again, you probably know more than I do because I've only had experience with the slow speed grinder. I can only speak for the slow speed grinder. And I can say that the reason why I decided to go with a slow speed grinder was because that's what my mentor used, right? To sharpen his hand tool, or excuse me, re-grind a an edge on his hand tools and lathe tools. But the benefit to having a slow speed grinder is that it can be used for a bunch of other things that don't have to do with woodworking necessarily. It's a little bit more of a versatile tool, whereas a wet grinder is very specific to edge tools, and it's going to give you a much more refined hollow grind and edge. But since I'm honing a micro bevel on a diamond plate, on diamond plates afterwards, it really doesn't matter. That's pretty much, you know, my recommendation would be to go with a slow speed grinder. There are a lot of used slow speed grinders on the market that you can get, and they're relatively inexpensive. I would say go with an inexpensive slow speed grinder, and then maybe later on, if you want to, get some CBN wheels. They'll last you forever. Sean, do you use either a bench grinder or a wet grinder, and what are your thoughts on both?
Yeah, I only have experience. I also bought the Rikon, the 80-805. It's the 8-inch slow speed grinder. Like we mentioned, it's 1750 RPM. I bought this primarily to use to sharpen turning tools when I first started turning, but now I've switched over to using the Wood Easy tools or Easy Wood tools or whatever they're called with a replaceable carbide tipped. Yep, the carbide tipped. But the Rikon comes with a 60 grit and 120 grit wheel that I still have on there. And I do sometimes use it because I have a traditional set of turning tools that I do use sometimes. So I'll fire it up and use it. But again, you have to use the diamond wheel dresser on the wheels to keep them flat and true and all that stuff. It is what it is. It's a great, cheap, slow speed bench grinder. I don't think you're going to go wrong with it. And like we has on his, you can upgrade the wheels later on. I don't have much experience with, actually no experience with the Wen or any other sort of wet grinder. So I can't speak on that, but the Rikon that I have is a very good grinder for the price and what it comes with, the wheels that it comes with for that task. I know some people have complained about the Rikon having some vibration issues. Mine does vibrate quite a bit, but not too bad. It's nothing that has impacted the quality of the sharpening session or anything. But other than that, it's been a great slow speed grinder. What about you, guy? What are you using over there?
I don't own a grinder. I've never, ever owned a grinder. So I really don't know how much I can add to this. I've seen them used. I've talked to people that use them. I know a couple guys that have Tormex that just think they're the cat's pajamas, the bee's knees, whatever you want to call it. If I were to get one, I would probably get something like the Tormek, just because, you know, I'd be really worried about, and I wouldn't be using it on turning tools because I don't turn unless I absolutely have, only if I have a gun to my head will I turn. But for like plane blades and chisel irons, I've been sharpening that stuff so long, I've kind of have a system down and I've never seen the need to do it. But I think for some people, the Tormek is probably a very good option. I've seen people get really good results with it and heard nothing but good things about them. I don't know much about the CBN or M.
N is in Nancy.
I've seen those on grinders. You know, people have some videos out on them and such. And they're sharpening their tools. Again, I'm not going to offer an opinion or anything because I've never used any of that stuff.
Yeah.
The Tormek is expensive. So it depends on how much you're going to use this thing too. If you're doing a lot of regrinding or turning and you need, because you're looking at about over $700 for a Tormek.
Yeah. And then you've got to buy all the little jigs for them.
Yeah. But Zach's talking about copies of the Tormek, like when Grizzly, Triton, and they're significantly less expensive. Yeah. I think the Wen is like $120 or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Do you guys remember the Yugo?
The car?
Yeah, the car.
Yeah.
It was a brand new car you could buy for, you know, I think at the time it was like $3,000 or $4,000. It's a car. It had an engine and four wheels and it went. Doesn't mean it's going to operate like a Ferrari. So I'm assuming that the Wen at $120 is $120 worth of tool. If it's trying to copy the Tormek at, you know, or $800, and then you got to spend another $500 or $600 just to get the jigs you need to do stuff with.
Oh, the jigs are expensive for a Tormek.
The jigs are real expensive and they don't come with it.
No.
I see the Wen as like a Yugo, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you may have some issues with it running true or not, you know, make sure there's no wobble in the wheels and how long is it going to last?
I always question things like that where I say, oh, it's so cheap. Well, yeah, it's cheap.
And coming from me, and I'm probably one of the cheapest woodworkers you'll find, I don't think I would probably get the win. I'd probably look at the Rikon, but I've not used it. It may be great.
Yeah, could be. We'd like to know if you do get it.
Absolutely.
Sean, what question do you have for us?
My first question is from Christopher. Wondering what you guys recommend for a good doweling jig that can do both wide and thin stock. Also, your opinion on the Triton dowel jointer. When I first started, I bought the self-centering, cheap $20 to $30 doweling jig that I think I bought from Harbor Freight. Again, I'm a cheap woodworker, so that's what I started with, and it works great for basic rails and styles, you know, self-centering. Clamp it into place, make sure it doesn't move, drill holes, and you're good to go. Another option that I looked at, and if I didn't have the Domino or anything like that, and I wanted a versatile doweling jig, I would look at the Dowelmax. Coming in at $225, you're gonna be able to use it for more than just basic rails and styles. You can offset the joinery using some shims that they include or sell separately. So if you wanted to, say, inset an apron on the side of a leg, you can use these shims to offset that. And with the available spacers, you can also use it on thicker parts, even up to 4x4 legs. One really cool thing about it is they have little different type of guides and shims and stuff, and one of them will allow you to drill on a miter on edge. So I know that you can use a traditional doweling jig for some tasks like that, but this will allow you to reinforce miters on edge. They've got a 45 degree plate that you can use. I know Jessam also makes a really nice doweling system, and I've not compared it to Dowelmax, but just briefly looking at it, I personally would pick the Dowelmax just because of the options and some of the accessories that you can buy is going to give you probably a more versatile doweling jig. Mm-hmm. But one feature that both the Jessam and the Dowelmax have that I like is the ability to drill on the face of a board instead of only on the end or an edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's super handy for using the dowel joinery on things like cabinetry. I know the Wood Whisperer used the Dowelmax in one of his videos on putting together a drill charging station, and he used it for that. So if you want to see that in action, he's got a video. But that is a really cool feature of those two jigs. The Dowelmax for $225 currently is a really good deal if you're looking for a versatile doweling jig. As far as my opinion on the Triton doweling jointer, I've never used it, but every review that I've read has been negative. You know, yeah. From the adjustment mechanism being sloppy to the springs being extremely stiff and just overall accuracy issues. Again, I've not used it, so I'm not sure. I can't speak from experience, but it's probably not something that I would recommend to any woodworking friend. Just from the reviews and the videos I've seen on it. But again, do your own research before buying something like that. That's been my experience. Started out with a cheap, and then if I were to move up, I'd probably get a Dowelmax or just start with a Dowelmax. Wee, what about you? What are your experiences with dowel joinery and jigs?
My experience with dowel joinery has mostly been with face frames, and I used Rockler's version of a self-centering doweling jig. There are a lot of other Chinese copies that are out there that you can find on Amazon for just face frames. And honestly, even if you wanted to do board glue-ups or panel glue-ups, that's going to be perfectly fine. After that, I had gotten the Domino that kind of, you know, substituted all the things that I would have used the self-centering
Same
doweling
here.
Jig for. That being said, you know, if you're just using it for panel glue-ups and face frames, the inexpensive $50 Chinese copies or the Rockler self-centering doweling jig is going to work just perfectly fine for you. And I do agree that if I were to use dowel joinery as my primary source of joinery, then I would probably get like a Dowelmax or the Jessam. Now, in terms of the Triton
doweling jointer.
Yeah. Steve over at the Extreme Woodworker did a really great comparison of the Triton Duo dowel joiner with the Maffle dual dowel joiner. And he pretty much kind of came to the same consensus that I think a lot of other people had, which was the Triton dowel joiner just needs a lot of work before it can compete with either the Domino or Maffle's version of the dowel joiner. So that's about all I can add with that. Guy, what do you use as a dowel joiner?
I've had one of the little self-centering dowel jigs for, I don't know, well over 30 years now. And there was a time, my young friends, when you either did a mortise and tenon or you used dowels. That was it. There was no biscuit joiners. There was no dominoes. There was none of that stuff. There was just dowels. And used them a lot. Quite a bit, as a matter of fact. and just use that little cheap doweling jig. Anytime I wanted to do dowels in the center of a panel, it's actually really easy. Mm-hmm. You use the doweling jig to do the shelf, let's say, mm-hmm. or the divider, and then you use these things called dowel centers. Mm-hmm. And there's little metal pins that fit into the dowel holes that have a point on them. You line up your board, you hit it with a hammer, and it puts little points in the wood, and you just drill holes with a drill, and you're off to the races. Dowel joinery is very strong. It works really well. I still use dowels quite a bit, even though I have a domino and a biscuit joiner and everything else. There's times where it just makes sense. In a lot of cases, I'm not even using the self-centering jig. I'm just drilling a hole, putting a dowel center in there and pressing it up against the piece I want to join. Dowel joiners that I've looked at, I've seen the Jessam in pictures. I've never really looked at its features, so I can't say anything about that. I almost bought a Dowel Max once, and it looks like a really, really nice doweling jig. I know a guy that uses it a lot in just about every build he does, and he really loves it. Brian McKnight. I don't know if you guys know Brian. He does quite a bit with it. That's about all I can add. If you're thinking about getting a dowel jig, look at just the cheap centering jig, and that's really all you need, unless you're really going to get into doweling as your primary source or your primary way of joining, then look at the Dowel Max. But if it's like an occasional thing, just get the self-centering one and some dowel centers. As far as the Triton doweling thing, I've seen the videos you're talking about, Hui, with Steve from the Extreme Woodworker, and he's comparing it to a Mefel. Again, that's like the whole Wen versus the Tormek thing.
Yep.
The Mefel is probably, you know, $20,000. I really don't know how much it costs, but it's probably well over $1,000. You're comparing, when he did that review, I'm like, dude, you're comparing this. I'm not saying anything bad about Triton because I own some Triton stuff.
Yep.
But that particular thing, I think it's like $200 or $300.
Oh, yeah.
Comparing that to the Mefel, which is probably well over $1,000.
It's $1,281.
Okay. So again, there's my point. It's a cheap knockoff of, I think Mefel is either Austrian or German.
Yeah.
But it's a high quality piece of equipment versus a very low quality piece of equipment.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't even bother with it. Andy Klein also did a thing where he used that, and he had to do all these he did a couple videos where he did all these modifications to it.
Yeah.
Just to get it to work decent. You know, I've never used it, but just seeing what knowing what I've seen on the internet, and if it's on the internet, it must be true. That's all I can really add to that.
Well, to keep the ball on your court, you've got the next question.
All right. This comes from John Vigorito. Hey guys, love the podcast. I have, I think, an easy question. This is my first project with hardwoods other than poplar trimming, so here it goes. I'm making one of those balancing wine holders as a birthday gift, but I want to dress it up a bit. I have a piece of hard maple, and I want to frame the maple with a 1/2-inch to 3/4 strip of purple heart around it, mitered in the top corners. The overall dimensions will be about 15 by 5.5, and my question is this. Top piece of purple heart would be running the grain perpendicular to the maple. Is this a bad idea? Should I cross-cut that strip of purple heart so all the grain is running the length of the piece? Let's answer the first question. It says, is this a bad idea? Yes.
Ouch.
Don't do it. Don't ever. And when you've got a solid piece of wood, we've talked about this before, and you've got a solid piece of wood, it's going to expand and contract across the grain. So if you've got grain running up and down, and then you try to glue a piece on top of it, and then you've got the grain running side to side, and it's mitered, and it's like framed in, all that's going to happen is eventually those miters joints are just going to pop. It's just not going to work. You can't do that. That's a cross grain situation. And he's saying, you know, should I cross cut that strip of purple heart so the grain is running the length of the piece? That would make it really weak. Any way you look at it, you really can't frame a piece of solid wood with other solid wood. because like I said, it's just going to split the miters. I know this firsthand from a chessboard I built, oh my Lord, when I was in ninth grade. So how old would that make me in ninth grade? 13, 14 years old?
Yeah, I guess.
Maybe somewhere around there?
15? Yeah, 14, 15.
14, 15?
We'll go 14 and a half.
Somewhere around there. I believe it or not, I still have that chessboard, but the miters are all split on it. It just looks horrible.
Yeah.
You can't do that. He actually sent us or sent Sean a picture. Or did you pull it off of Instagram?
No, Sean? it's on our Instagram. So he sent it to us.
And I looked at it and it may look good now. And it does look pretty good, but I can almost guarantee that those miters are going to split probably in the summertime when the humidity comes up, and it's going to soak up some of that. And don't do it. That's the only thing I can say. Do you have anything to add to that, Hui?
I've experienced it. It's happened to me. I've done the same thing that he has, where I've taken a solid piece of oak to make a bench, and then I put molding that I had run on my router table around the top of the solid piece of oak. And sure enough, the miters opened up. So I know from experience, it's happened. Sean? It happens. It does. It works. Wood expansion works.
Yeah, there's no running away from it. I guess I've just been lucky enough not to have tried it yet. Yeah, and typically when you see someone do something like frame in a panel like that on a tabletop or something, they're typically using some man-made MDF plywood, veneered plywood or MDF center panel framed in with solid wood. And that's going to be fine because it's not going to be an issue. And, you know, the smaller the piece is, the less it's going to move, but still it's going to move. So something that's 5-6 inches wide, it's still going to move. And you may just have hairline gaps on the miters. It may be larger than that, but it's going to move, and there's nothing that you can do to stop it. So in the future, just work around that somehow, maybe figure out how to veneer a nice little panel like that. And by the way, that the wine holder, it does look really awesome. I love the wood combination in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the future, just avoid doing that, or maybe pick up some veneering, do your pretty cool design in the center and miter that. Hui, what about you? What do you got for us on your next question?
So my next question is from Mobile Builds, and he writes, "Hey guys, I have a question regarding electric hand planes. I'm looking at buying an electric hand plane, likely the Triton 3-blade unlimited rebate planer instead of a nice Veritas low angle plane. I don't finish with a card scraper or a smoothing plane as I haven't had enough practice, yet I'm very pleased with the results I get sanding. Am I crazy to think that an electric hand plane will do a great job at taking down high spots to flatten a tabletop over a finely tuned hand plane? I'm finishing by sanding, so I don't need the plane to leave a glassy smooth surface. I need the high spots gone and gone quickly. I ask because I don't see many other woodworkers using this method, but in my mind, it seems much more efficient if finishing by sanding. I'd love to hear your response on the podcast." Well, I think an electric hand plane is perfectly fine to take down high spots. In fact, actually, I have an electric powered hand plane, and I've used it for that exact reason. But you do need to be very careful with an electric hand powered hand plane. You can easily remove too much material, and it can happen very, very fast. And they also tend to leave a ridge at the ends of where the blades are. So if you're looking to get a surface smooth so that you can finish playing with it, that might be an issue because you're going to have ridges and it's going to be hard to really gauge one side of the board getting that flat and then the other side of the board to be on the same plane as the side that you did before. Now, the benefit to using an electric hand plane is obviously the speed and ease of use, but that's also sort of its downfall too, is the speed at which it removes the material. So you want to identify all the high spots and periodically check your progress with, you know, straight edge, winding sticks, whatever you're wanting to use. And once you take down all those high spots, I don't think it's going to be as close to finish ready as you might think. You might actually consider finding a place that might have a planer or borrowing a tabletop planer or a dedicated planer. If that planer has a long enough bed to reference off of, you can get a board relatively flat and then run it through the planer to try to get the other side flat. And then you can flip the board over and then get the side that you had run the electric hand planer down, that entirely flat as well. So just work slowly. I don't think if your expectation is to get it finished ready for sanding, you might want to reconsider, but to take down the high spot so that you can maybe send it through a dedicated planer, then that might be an option. Guy, what do you think about electric powered hand planes?
It's another one of those tools I don't own and have never used. I think it's more than anything else a carpentry tool used by rough carpenters.
Yeah.
I can see if you're working with slabs, mm-hmm. I can see that as a semi-valuable tool to have. But in the type of work that I do, which is mostly furniture, it really doesn't have a place. And the way I'm reading this question is, am I crazy to think that an electric hand plane will do a great job of taking out high spots to flatten a tabletop? Here's my take on that. I've glued up a lot of panels and tabletops in my lifetime. One of the things I've learned is to glue it up flat. Start with really well-machined material. That's four sides square. Don't put 8,000 pounds of clamp pressure on it. And your tabletop should be flat. All you need to do is close the joint with your clamps. You get a little bit of squeeze out, and then I back the clamps off, because the clamping pressure is usually what causes a tabletop to go out of flat and mm-hmm. causes cupping and all kinds of different issues. And I know it sounds like a cop-out, but glue your tabletops up flat and you won't have that problem. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to your milling process and making sure that you actually have flat square stock to begin with. And as long as you have that, gluing it up is actually a pretty easy thing. Now, you can use biscuits, dowels, or dominoes to help with alignment, so the board is less likely to cup while you're putting clamp pressure on it. I see people putting clamps underneath the tabletop and then on top of the tabletop to equalize the pressure. Again, if you're putting that much pressure on it where you're bowing the top, that you need to put clamps on top of it to flatten it again, you've got way too much pressure on that joint and it's unnecessary. I see that a lot where people are just torquing down just an unbelievable amount on clamps. Too much clamp pressure usually is the cause of most problems. That's all I can really say on that. Sean?
Yeah, if you're using too much or too many clamps, if you're using it to close up gaps, that means you need to joint the edges again. You shouldn't have to fight that. Yeah, I agree with Guy. Make sure that you're starting this battle out with the lumber being as flat and true and square as possible. Yeah. If your stock is wider than your jointer but will fit in your planer, and again, we don't know what kind of power tools you have in your shop, so you may not have access to a planer and jointer. But if you do, you know, make a sled for your planer and to get everything nice and flat. And if you have something that's wider than your planer, glue up multiple pieces together, you know, glue it up in multiple stages. Mm-hmm. So like my workbench is 24, 26 inches wide. I did three or four glue ups of X amount of inches wide, eight or so inches wide in sections to make it more manageable. And that also gave me the opportunity, if I glue up eight inch wide sections, I could, after the glue dried, I could square those back up because I left everything a little thick. I could square it back up to then glue those three sections together to give me the 24 inch wide bench top. You know, that way you're only really fighting three pieces instead of potentially, you know, six to eight pieces. Just think about your methods for getting that tabletop glued up and the lumber surfaced and squared and all that stuff to start out without a battle on your hands, an uphill battle, I guess, and to start at the lumber. Again, we don't know what kind of power tools you have, so it's kind of hard to say, but I don't have any experience with the power planers, never used one. And if I had to use it on something like slabs, I go to my router sled.
Yeah, good point.
That's another option. If you have a big router, slab that you need to flatten, use a router sled. And there's plenty of videos out there on how to do that.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
I would only use an electric hand plane for taking down a high spot here and there. I wouldn't use it for flattening entire board because I don't think you're going to get the consistency that you need to make furniture grade tabletops. All right, Sean, I think you've got the next one.
Awesome. This one is Tom the Builder 17 on Instagram. Hey guys, just started listening to your show. I'm new to woodworking and every episode I've learned something new from you guys. Love the show. I'm starting to work with hardwoods for the first time. Been wanting to make cutting boards, coasters, cigar ashtrays, etc. Looking into thin kerf blades, but don't know much about them. So my first question is, are they necessary? And secondly, which ones do you suggest? And he gives a few examples on here that I've not used, so I can't say much about those, like the Froy 10-inch and Amana tool. I don't know much about those. I've not used those, so I'm just going to give recommendations based off of the ones that I've used. Let's see. You first ask, are they necessary? And man, this is a hot topic. Some people say no. Some people say yes. When I got my first table saw, it was a 1.75 horsepower hybrid. So I went with a full curve blade. And when I was cutting 8/4 maple or 8/4 walnut, it was burning and it was very, very, very slow to cut. I switched to a thin kerf and had really good luck with it. Less waste, easier for low power table saws, so it's less strain on the motor. I did not have any issues with deflection and vibration, which some people say they have. I had a good experience with thin kerf blades when I used them on my Craftsman 1 3/4 horsepower. Things to remember if you are using a thin kerf blade is you need to check your riving knife, make sure that it's acceptable and thin enough to use with a thin kerf blade. If not, you need to address that before using it. But the thin kerf blade that I used was a Froy 10-inch 42 thin kerf Premier Fusion. And I used it for rip, crosscut, on hardwoods, and I used it on sheet goods. And it did a really, really good job for me. No tear out on sheet goods. I think it's worth investigating and seeing if you have any issues with deflection and vibration. Again, I didn't have that. I used the thin kerf the whole time that I had my 1 3/4 horsepower Craftsman table saw. And another one that I used was their the Froy thin kerf glue line rip was the model of that one. And again, it did a fantastic job. No issues, clean cut. I didn't have the burning issues anymore, and I was able to cut the wood faster than with a full kerf blade. But again, you can skip that. Try using a full kerf blade first. See if your saw will accept it and cut and it's acceptable. And if so, and you're not having any burning or anything like that, stick with the full kerf blade. I'm not sure what saw you have, but if it came with a full kerf blade and it's not extremely crappy, give it a try and see how the saw acts. But don't be afraid to try thin kerf blades. I've not had any issues with it. But that's not to say that you won't. I know we've talked about that before on the show, so I'm going to lead this one off to Guy because I think he feels a little different than I do.
Tom is not really giving us any insight as to why he thinks he needs a thin kerf ripping blade. Mm-hmm. He's just saying he's going to start working with hardwoods, and I'm looking into thin kerf blades, but don't know much about them. And he's not really giving us a reason why he's looking at thin kerf blades.
What I took from that was cutting boards are thicker. Coasters aren't, so I don't know. But cigar ashtrays, I guess I just took from it that he's working with thicker material.
Yeah. I had a 1 3/4 horsepower contractor saw for a number of years, but I never saw the need to have a thin kerf blade on it. I was cutting, 8/4 maple and all that. And again, just never had an issue with it. I do have, even on my saw right now is a 5 horsepower. Every now and then, if I'm cutting 8/4 stock, I do have a 24 tooth, regular thickness kerf, but I do have a 24 tooth ripping blade that I use. There's no reason to bog down the motor or anything like that, but just sometimes I feel like I should be using that, and that's just force of habit. What I'd recommend doing, Tom, is trying it with your, I don't know what type of table saw you have either. You might want to try, your regular blade first on the thicker woods. If it seems to be causing an issue, take a look before you go out and buy a new blade that, might be $100 or $80. Take a look at using a circular saw blade that's 7 1/4 inches. You can get about a 2-inch cut on that. Mm-hmm. And that will work on a 5/8 inch arbor. I use one of those all the time on my saw for woods that are, semi-precious, we'll call it, ebony and things like that. And I don't want to waste a bunch of wood. And it's got a 16th of an inch kerf on it. But you might want to try something like that. I don't have any experience with the 10-inch thin kerf blades because myself, I never thought I needed one. Have you ever felt the need to have a thin kerf blade on your table saw?
I never felt the need to have a thin kerf blade. I had two thin kerf blades because they came with the contractor table saw that I had bought used. And so I just continued to use them. See, I don't even know if they had deflection in them, primarily because they came with a blade stabilizer, so which was an aftermarket blade stabilizer. And I do know that some folks that have issues with thin kerf blades either deflecting or wobbling with thicker material, they use these blade stabilizers to essentially stiffen up the blade. It's a piece of a machine plate on either side. And the issue with that is that it actually decreases the depth of cut that you can have with that blade. When I moved to a cabinet saw, I had an old Grizzly cabinet saw. I bought a full kerf blade. And again, the only reason why I used the thin kerf blade was because it's what came with the saw when I bought it. As to whether or not you need it to cut hardwood, the way I'm reading the question is he's asking if whether or not he needs a thin kerf blade to cut hardwoods. And I would say, no, you don't need a thin kerf blade to cut hardwoods. I mean, even the ripping blades that I have are full kerf. So I don't see a need to have a thin kerf blade to cut hardwood.
Yeah, if we had more information on what saw you're currently using, I think that would help just a little bit. But if you're due to lack of power, you may get the hardwood first and try. I mean, you're going to start working with it anyways. Buy it and try it. If it's struggling or burning, try the thin kerf blade.
It's a good point.
Yep. All right. So that answers that. Guy, off to you.
This question is from Justin. Thanks so much for putting out this podcast. It's made my boring commute to work a whole lot more enjoyable. Well, we're glad to help you out there, Justin. So here's his question. What are your thoughts on using the metric system in your shop? As an American woodworker, I primarily use imperial units for measuring, but have found it easier to switch to metric for certain tasks like dividing a space by an odd number. That's a really good question, and I'm a lot like you, Justin. I use both. 99% of the time I'm using imperial, but there's times like I was doing just today, as a matter of fact, where I was trying to divide something by three. And when you've got a measurement, you know, of like 19 and 5/8, trying to divide that by three is very difficult. So taking a number like 1500 millimeters and dividing it by three is really easy. Mm-hmm. And that's typically when I use metric. I know there's some people that use metric for everything. I have a friend of mine, Eric Clavinger.
Yep.
Poplar Shop.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Old Eric.
Yeah, Eric's awesome. He does everything in metric. And the reason I don't use metric as much as I think I probably should is because it's hard for me to visualize it. I mean, if you tell me something is 2 3/4 inches wide, I can visualize that in my head and go, oh, okay, yeah, I know how thick that is. If you tell me something is 800 millimeters wide, I'm going, let's see, how many are in that? So,
yeah, I'm right there with you on that.
And I'm trying to do all this math in my head. It actually makes it more difficult. But for certain tasks, it makes it a lot easier. So there are times I use metric, and there's times when I'm mostly using imperial. But I'm right there with you, Justin. Sean, what are your thoughts on it?
They pretty much are the same as yours, especially I've started using, switching over and using metric system for running the CNC machine because a lot of the controls in carbide motion are metric. So like offsets. And so it's extremely handy. I find it easier for dealing with some precise measurements and stuff on the CNC machine. It's easier for me to read if it's 2 millimeters versus whatever that is in the imperial system. But yeah, I also have the issue of I'm not quite good enough with, okay, if something is 20 inches, that's 678 millimeters or whatever that is. That doesn't connect in my brain just yet on, okay, what is 600 millimeters? What is that close to in inches? I'm not there yet, but I would like to get there. It's just so much easier with the metric system. It's just unfortunate that, you know, I didn't start earlier and younger at learning the metric system. But eventually, I'd like to switch over.
Completely?
I would like to. I don't think I would ever get away from the imperial units just because of where I live, obviously. But I just think that it would be just be a little bit easier for me. That's just a personal preference. But Hui, what are your thoughts on that?
I feel the exact same way. 99% of the time I'm using Imperial, and those times where I have to get really odd divisions on things, I use Metric. Nice thing is that actually when I was getting into woodworking, I actually bought all my rules and tape measures with both Imperial and Metric on them. I think that would be a great way of sort of introducing Metric into your workflow. Even with that, it's still kind of hard for me to visualize what 22 millimeters is. That's my take on it. I use Imperial most of the time.
There are times, again, where I've tried to do everything in Metric on a project, and it was just too difficult for me. I just couldn't do it. It didn't make any sense. So I was lucky enough when I was very young that they were trying to make everything Metric. So I learned at an early age all the Metric stuff, you know, measurements and, you know, volume, liters and milliliters and all that stuff. But it just never took hold. But they were trying to switch everything over to Metric here in the United States at one time. That was in the 70s. Anyways, I think that about answers all the questions.
I think that's it.
So, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to recommend some folks to follow on social media. And who do you recommend for us?
I've got Les Hastings. It's Les.Hastings1. That's Les.Hastings1. And I really like what he's doing because he's doing some really great period furniture. He's doing awesome millwork. His stuff is very clean. It's very precise. It's just gorgeous stuff. I've been following him for a little while now. The stuff that he does just blows my mind. I'm really glad that I follow him because it gives me some really good inspiration. Guy, how about you? Who are you following?
The person I'm recommending, her name is Ashley, and it's really easy. It's a Build Like a Chick. I met Ashley last year at Weekend with Wood for Wood Magazine, and she's really super nice, and her Instagram is pretty cool. It's kind of like we're watching her on her journey as she started out making very simple stuff, and it's getting more increasingly complicated as time goes on. And she builds a lot of farmhouse style rustic things, and she does a really good job doing real joinery, and she's using real hardwoods, and she does a really good job. And I really recommend giving her a follow. What about you, Hui? Or about you, Sean?
My pick for this episode is a Japanese furniture maker. His username is 910moko_woodwork. It's 910moko_woodwork. Extremely talented. I really dig his style. Some of the joinery that he showcases on there is just top notch. And the photography and the vibe of I don't know if it's his or whoever, if it's a company, but the vibe on their channel or their feed rather is awesome. Something that I really enjoy looking at. It's very inspirational. So that's my pick for this episode.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for the show. And we'd like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate all the support and feedback. And please remember that this podcast here is Answer Questions from the Woodworking Community. So if you have a woodworking question you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com. Or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. And you can reach me at guyswoodshop.com. And where can you be found, Hui?
You can find me at alabamawoodworker.com. Sean, where can we find you?
Simplecove.com and at Simplecove on Instagram and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter.
Nice.
All right, great. We will see you guys next time.
See ya.
See ya.